books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwoods, and today we've got two more authors on the Yodo Carnegie Medal shortlist for writing. Nathaniel Lesor with Steady for This and Sophie Cameron with Away with Words. All that, plus we'll find some new books in the RNIB library. Nathaniel Lesor was born in Camberwell, southeast London, and grew up in Peckham. He was one of eight children to French and Madagascan parents. Writing his first book, Steady for This, gave him the opportunity to show his southeast London childhood as funny, warm, and adventurous, a way that it wasn't always represented. The audio version of Steady for This is read by Kuda Dotiro Robinson.
My name is Sean Thompson, but people call me Growls because I growl like a tiger before my rhymes. Yeah, they call me Growls. I'm like a tiger on the prowl. King of jungle, so you better take a bow. King of concrete, so you better say it loud. You best believe there's more where that came from. Man's got bars for days, like a prison or a vending machine, you feel me? It's Monday morning, so I'm in my form group. Can't lie, I'm one of the top 30 students in my class, but I figured out how to stand out from the crowd and get Tanisha to notice me. The minute she clocks my rap skills, I know she'll be super on it. I'm sat next to Shanks, my partner in grime, but the space next to him is empty because only the cool kids sit at the back. Shanks is legit my OG. Swear down, he's had my back since day. His mum and my mum started chatting outside the gates when we were in primary school. Then Mrs. Shanks sometimes took me to their house after school if my mum was working late. Shout out receptionist jobs. The first time I went to his yard, I didn't want to leave. Man had kitchen tiles and matching curtains on some interior design wave, and his garden was a private one, not even for the whole block. What got me most, though, was when his mum said we were eating lamb for dinner. I thought it was going to be some kind of kebab shape, but this thing was on the bone. She called it Lamb Shanks for her little lamb, and that's how Shanks got his nickname, Little Lamb. But people at school mocked it when I called him that, so we changed it to Lamb Shanks. Shanks for short.
Alright, I got this. Yeah, no, steady for this. It's a story of MC Growls. Real name is Sean Bethany Ezekiel Frankel, but he goes by MC Growls. He is a pretty terrible rapper, I think it's fair to say. Sean attempts to impress his crush at school, Tanisha. He live streams a rap performance with him and his best friend, Shanks, who together they make MC Squared. And so they're live streaming a rap performance, and Grouse's mum interrupts the live stream, holding up a pair of his pooey underwear. And from there, things kind of go a bit downhill for Grouse. So Shanks, who's also complicit in the embarrassment, he had his finger in his armpit to test the strength of the deodorant he was wearing. But he basically gets, Shanks gets bullied, like, pretty bad, so probably has to leave school for a bit. And so Growls, he's also facing eviction, and he needs to enter a reptology competition to use the winnings to save from being evicted. He's got quite a lot of help along the way, mainly Siobhan, who's quite a kind of boss character in a way, and she kind of teaches him a lot about the world. Yeah, he's also got Mr. Ricks, who's an English teacher, who's kind of, over the course of the book, becomes a bit of a male role model. And Karen, who's his school guidance counsellor, who's incredibly patient, let's say.
Have you heard of a book called 1066 and All That?
No, I've not heard of it.
It reminded me of 1066 and All That, because that's a book about all the things you kind of remembered from history, but you weren't really listening. It's a really funny misunderstanding of what he's half heard in class.
I mean, yeah, no, I think that's a pretty accurate take. Like, one of my favorite lines that we talked about recently was he's talking about the Battle of Waterloo Station, you know, and he says that Queen Victoria didn't do anything except invent a train station after herself, you know, and yeah, there's a quite a bit of that, you know, yeah.
Did grills make you laugh when you were writing it?
I mean, all the time, and even now, I always say that my favorite thing about this book is I can open it on any random page and find something incredibly silly that he says. Yes, it's one of my favorite things. You know, we were talking the other day about the even the chapter titles, and he's talking about Leonardo DiCaprio and the Sistine Chapels and all that kind of stuff. So, I think that's part of the reason I enjoyed it so much was I got to invent the silliest conversations and not just Grouse's one-liners, but I loved having him bounce off the more serious characters, you know, like Siobhan and Adrian, who's his older brother. Yeah, I did make myself laugh quite a lot and still do with the book, you know, and I was saying with the editing process, if a joke didn't work or progress a story, I would write six or seven different lines and different jokes. And so because of that, the editor would just pick their favorite joke. And so now when I'm rereading it, there's stuff that I didn't know I wrote because obviously I gave them six or seven different options. And so some of it is even a surprise to me. All day, I'm shameless to say that. Yeah, I made myself laugh on the bus, on the train, walking down the street with a big grin on my face, thinking I can't wait to get home and write this silly line. Yeah, no, all day it was super fun.
Me and Shanks, we've been tight ever since. It wasn't too long after that when I decided we should become a rap duo. He weren't super on it at first, but he saw the light. I told Shanks that people would sing our names from the mountaintops, where milk flows like honey and goat farmers sing Christmas carols in the midwinter. I was going to make enough money to get the real cereal, and not the one with the fake bumblebee that doesn't even have a name. You could say Shanks's MC skills aren't levels with mine, but he's mad smart and wise, like one of those talking owls from a cartoon. He taught me that banoffee pie is called that because it's a mix of banana and toffee. And last week he gave me good advice on how to finally make Tanisha my number one.
How much of your own childhood is in there?
Embarrassingly, lots and lots and lots. When I go and do school visits, you know, there was a scene, and I talk about this a lot, where Grouse gets stuck in a pushchair. And my editors kind of, you know, said, "Oh, how did you even think of that?" The true story behind that, and I don't think it's a spoiler for the book, is when I was younger, but still too old to get stuck in a pushchair, my mum would push my little brothers around, and this thing had like a really, really firm strap. And I remember I was never able to undo it, and so I thought, like, one day, I thought, okay, I'm going to test my own strength. And in the little communal area of the block of flats we lived in, I got home after school and strapped myself in, and obviously inevitably got stuck. And my mind was racing, and I was thinking, you know, I'm gonna die in this pushchair. I'm gonna starve to death. And after about 20 minutes or way too long, I decided to wriggle up out of the straps. And then when my belt buckle got caught, I had to kick my shoes off and take my trousers off, which was very embarrassing because my mum still bought my clothes, and I had a little pair of, you know, tiny postman Pat underwear, but I was still dressed in my school uniform from the waist up. And you know, well, after a while, I might have been in there for about an hour, and a neighbor came out. And passed me, and we made eye contact, and neither of us said anything. He just caught me, you know, yeah, in my pants from the waist down. I would have been about 14, 15, so again, way too old. And so every single anecdote in Steady for this that sounds too ridiculous or a little bit out there, like in real life, it's not. you know, and the like all the kind of big set pieces, you know, he brings yogurt or a bucket of yogurt on a date to the cinema, you know, stuff like that. Like, yeah, it's unfortunately those scenes were based in real life. We were taught at uni to write what you know, and I did exactly that.
Was it important to see yourself in a book? Because I can't imagine there'd be many books growing up that reflected where you came from.
Early on in my kind of like teenagehood, I did enjoy reading, and my dad would always, I had the collection of Spike Milligan. He had a collection of war memoirs, you know, and I did all the classics of, you know, the Narnias and the Potters and all of that. And yeah, I definitely, I fell out of love with reading. I just wasn't anywhere, like at all, you know. Yeah, it was tough because obviously I grew up in Peckham at a time before Sour Bread and Smashed Abbo, where there was like, you know, there was a bit of a stigma, you know, to growing up, especially I grew up in the North Peckham estate, and all the stories were negative, you know, everything was about knife crime and police and everything. Whereas, you know, my childhood wasn't any of that. I had quite a fun childhood. You know, it really is like you know, there's a sense of camaraderie, a sense of community, you know, just riding your bike around the ends and you know, hanging out after school. And none of that was ever in any books. You know, if there was ever a narrative, it was something negative. Whereas, you know, my life growing up at Peckham was quite funny. And so, yeah, it was important for me to reflect not just, you know, my true life experience, but hopefully have other kids who you know, grew up in an estate see themselves. And yeah, that for me was very important. And I might not have fallen out of love with reading if there were more characters who looked or sounded like me or who grew up in a similar area. I do think it would have changed things. It would have changed my relationship with reading, I think.
If you put Vaseline on your eyelashes, it will make them look longer, he said. I guess it would have worked, except I used half a tub and the school sent me home because it looked like I had an eye infection. But none of that matters now. When I'm a famous rapper, I won't have to worry about getting girls to like me. They'll see that I've got loads of bars and money. Man, rappers are so lucky that they can buy anything they want and not worry about their mum saying no. Yeah, being rich and famous would make you lonely because you'd be living in a big house by yourself, Shanks whispers to me while our form tutor takes the register. And I guess he's got a point. I think that's why they've all got those girls by the pools, popping bottles. It means they've always got someone to talk to. Big mansions are always the first ones to get haunted too. Imagine having all that money though. You could eat food with more than three ingredients all the time, buy clothes that fit you perfectly, and you wouldn't have to worry about turning everything off at the plug to save electricity.
The audio version is read by Kuda Donita Robinson. Did you have a hand in the casting of the book?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I always say, like, it takes 20 people to publish a book. My only job, really, is from page one to, you know, to the last page. And I think the people who are smarter than me, which is basically everyone in publishing, they have those decisions. Like, I think out of courtesy, they'll say, like, do you like this person, yes or no, you know, and I get to, I don't know, have the gladiatorial emperor thumbs up or thumbs down sometimes, you know. Even then, like, I'll go with what you think is right. And so far, as far as I'm aware, like 100% of their decisions have been right, you know. But like, he read the audiobook so well, and I've had people complimenting me on how great the audiobook was, but the real life story is like, I have absolutely nothing to do with it. Like, I'm just, you know, enjoying it along with anyone else. I can't take, you know, an inch of credit with any of that.
I've heard you read sections of the book. Did you not at one point think, I could maybe read the audiobook myself?
That thank you. I think that's a lovely compliment, but no, I get stage fright. I think reading out loud is a skill that I'm not I haven't mastered yet. When I was writing it, I would get my brother and my cousin who were, you know, my unofficial proofreaders. And so I loved it when they read it because they did so much more justice to the voice of Growls. It's a bit like singing in the shower, isn't it? Where it sounds a type of way in your head. And then when it comes out of your mouth, it's dreadful. I think that's my relationship with reading out loud. I take lots and lots and lots of practice to the point where I think my maximum potential is passable. You know, I did a reading out loud a couple months ago, and my younger brother had to come and you know, literally coach me on how to deliver my own words. Yeah, no, I mean, if you've heard me read out loud and you know, and I did a decent enough job, then that for me is a huge compliment.
The audiobook's now out there and it's also being translated into Braille. Is that important to you that it's now accessible to people with sight loss and other people with a print disability?
Yes, like all day. Like, I mean, like, get it out there. I think the whole theme of the book is accessibility, you know, and it's accessibility to the reader, to the readership, to all types of readers, and like top to bottom, you know, all types of readers. And yeah, I don't personally have anyone close to me in my life who is visually impaired, but you know, I mean, I don't know, it kind of gets me emotional, like the idea that it is available in Braille, you know, like kind of just speaks to the reach. And if I can brighten up anyone's day, like anywhere, or if the book can brighten anyone's day, I should say, then yeah, like that is that's a pretty big deal. You know, and yeah, no, thank you. I mean, yeah, no, thank you so much for that. Yeah, anyone reading or listening anywhere, I like really sincerely hope that you're just having a good time with it, you know.
Now, one thing we would miss if we download the audio version or access the Braille version is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of Steady for This?
I'll start by saying it was designed by Yoan Welsh, who the publishers found. Again, you know, 20 people to publish a book. So they found a graffiti artist, a Parisian graffiti artist on Instagram. And this guy, like, he graffitied the font of the title, which I mean, like, you know, humbly looks incredible. And it's, they went with the decision to make it fluorescent. So you've got in line with the graffiti theme, because you know, because it's set in Peckham, you've got bursts of color everywhere. So you've got greens and you know, blues and purples and everything. Like it's very, very, very colorful. And there's little bits kind of like behind the, you know, the amazing title font that kind of summarize the world as well as Growls. So you've got a pair of, you know, nice big headphones, you've got the hoops from the basketball cage, like that's how he met Siobhan. You know, you've got the microphone that represents Raptology, and you know, the musical theme throughout. And he's also done a, like, I would say a kind of illustration of Grouse. And the reason I say kind of is it was a discussion. I never explicitly describe Grouse's features. So he's featureless in a way. He doesn't have any kind of any description. You know, I often say, you know, what race would you assume Browse is? And I get different answers all the time. And when we talk about accessibility, I wanted any kid who's reading to see Growls as themselves. You know, so whatever you look like, whatever, you know, whatever race or ethnicity. Like, I want kids to be able to see themselves as Growls. That came from listening to Stan Lee, who was a creator of Marvel, and he was talking about Spider-Man. And when Stan Lee talks about Spider-Man, he said one of the things he loves is that Spider-Man's mask covers his entire face. And so Spider-Man could be anyone, you know, and obviously we know that that Peter Parker, you know, in kind of like the normal continuity is white, but Spider-Man wearing a full mask, you don't know that for sure, you know, and obviously we've got Miles Morales now, and you know, it's that, you know, it's trying to really make sure that you know, this character could look like anyone. And so on the illustration, we've got kind of outline of growls when the hoodie was paw print, because you know, because of the growling theme. But yeah, it's just that, and I think they did a bang up job of you know, representing that.
The bell for first period goes, and we head to English with Mr. Ricks. At the back of this class is where we write our sickest bars and practice freestyle battles. Sometimes Shank spits bars quieter when there's people about, but that's only because of copyright issues. Can't lie, writing bars in English is one of my favourite things about this subject. But the best thing about this lesson isn't here yet. I'm waiting for her to arrive, and I'm concentrating hard on the door so I don't miss her. Growls, why are you frowning like that? Shanks asks. Did a moth get stuck in your ear again? No, I ain't got a moth in my ear. This guy has a vivid imagination. It was just your average beetle. He asked me if I have a spare pen, but I can't respond. Tanisha just walked in and I'm bare distracted. She's parted her hair to the left today and her eye makeup has those little wings on them. Shanks rolls his eyes, but I don't care. Today's the day. Fam, you say that every day. The last time she actually talked to you, you got nervous and dropped your chicken bake on her shoe. Shanks is a liar. He wasn't even there when it happened. Tanisha and her friends always sit near us at the back. This one time I pulled out a chair for her to sit down, but she just laughed and carried on walking. Swear down, this girl needs to chill.
Steady for This by Nathaniel Lesore is available in print, ebook, and in audio commercially, and in audio and braille from RNIB. And Nathaniel Lesore, thank you so much.
Thank you. No, thank you. Thank you for interviewing me. Yeah, no, thank you very much.
Still to come on today's show, we'll hear from Sophie Cameron about her Yozo Carnegie shortlisted book, A Way with Words. After, we take a visit to the RNIB library to find some new books.
The Doctor Will See You Now by Amir Khan was donated by Penguin Random House.
My first day as a fully qualified GP. I had debated over whether to wear a tie or not. I wanted to make a good first impression, but didn't want to commit to something I couldn't sustain in the long term. In the end, I decided against the tie and went for a freshly ironed pale blue shirt and grey trousers. One of the nurses I used to work with advised me against wearing a white shirt on the first day of my job. You want them to think you've made an effort, but haven't peaked, she told me. Blue is a good colour to start with, and then there's room to move forward as time goes on. If you start with white, there's nowhere to go from there. For some reason, those words played in my head this morning. I put on my blue shirt. I was nervous. It was a new practice in a new area. I had completed my 3 years of GP training just 3 days ago. Many of my peers had opted to take a few weeks off before jumping into work, but, to be honest, I couldn't afford to. University had been expensive, and junior doctors don't get paid very much.
60 hours a week, 240 patients, 10 minutes to make a diagnosis. Welcome to the surgery. Charting his 15 years working as a GP from rookie to becoming a partner in one of the UK's busiest surgeries, Dr. Amir Khan's stories are as much about community and care as they are about blood tests and bodily fluids. Along the way, he introduces us to the patients that have taught him about love, loss and family, from the regulars to the rarities, giving him the most unbelievable highs and crushing lows, and often in just 10 minutes. There is the unsuspecting pregnant woman about to give birth at the surgery, the family who needs support through bereavement, the vulnerable child who will need continuing care for a long-term health condition, and of course, the onset of the COVID-19 that's tested the surgery at every twist and turn. But it's all in a day's work for Amir. The Doctor Will See You Now is a powerful story of hope, love and compassion, but it's also a rare insider account of what really goes on behind those surgery doors.
I pulled into the car park. There was a special area that said Doctor's Parking and was made up of 5 bays. Was I allowed to park here? I didn't want to park in someone else's space, but I was a doctor and I did work there. I grappled with it in my mind for a few moments. No, I thought. I couldn't, in case it meant one of the other doctors grumbled at me for having taken their space. I did a quick turnaround and parked in the patient's car park. I stared at the building. It looked so different to my training practice. I took a deep breath and grabbed the tin of biscuits I'd got from Sainsbury's the night before. I was going to give them to the receptionists. It was always good to get them on side. I got out of the car and headed towards the front door. There was a queue of patients waiting for the door to open. Did I just push past them to the front? How was I going to get in anyway? I didn't have a key. I decided to wait in the back of the line until the doors open. The man ahead of me turned to look at me. "You're a bit dressed up, aren't you?" he said, then started with a coughing fit. "It's my emphysema. This weather flares it up." He took out an inhaler from his pocket and tried taking a puff, which set his coughing off again. "What are you here for?" "Oh, I work here now," I said nervously. "First day today." "Work here? Well, I hope you can do something about the bloody appointment system. It's easier to get an appointment with the Queen than it is to see a doctor."
The doctor will see you now. The highs and lows of my life as an NHS GP by Amir Khan is read by the author and runs for 7 hours 26 minutes.
Simon and Schuster have recently given us this thriller. The Search Party is by Hannah Ritchell.
He has no idea how long he's been sitting there. There's no clock in the room. Just a table, 3 chairs, and a single narrow window set high into the wall. Too high to offer anything but a glimpse of the blank grey sky outside. It could have been 20 minutes since the police ushered him in and asked him to wait here, please. It could have been far longer. Dominic knows in moments of heightened stress that seconds can feel like minutes and minutes like hours, though the vending machine cup of tea someone brought him cooled ages ago. He also knows that every time he thinks about what might be happening outside this room, he feels a painful constriction in his chest, a tight band pressing vice-like against his lungs, making breathing hard. He would be more help out there, not shut away in a hospital consulting room, sitting in his damp clothing, waiting to answer questions, questions he's certain he won't have the answers to. But the 2 detectives have been insistent. He was to assist with their inquiries. Almost, he thinks, as if they suspect him of something.
Max and Annie Kingsley have left the London Ratways to set up a glamping site in the wilds of Cornwall. They invite old university friends, TV star Dominic, doctor and new mum Kira, and free-spirited Jim and Suze, and their children, for a trial weekend. But the reunion quickly veers off course. First, there's the incident around the campfire on the first night. The following afternoon, a storm quickly develops off the rugged north coast. When one of their group goes missing, all hell breaks loose. And as the winds batter the bell tents, emotions run high and tension mounts for all the characters. Who is lying in hospital? Who has gone missing? And who is the body on the beach below the cliffs?
The door opens and Dominic springs from his chair. "Any news?" he asks, his eyes darting from the lead police detective in her grey suit to her burly blonde colleague just behind. "Nothing yet, I'm afraid, Mr. Davies," she says. "Take a seat, please." Dominic hesitates. The last thing he wants to do is sit. "I think I'd be more use..." The detective raises her hand. "We've got a team scouring the site now. As soon as we know anything at all, we'll be sure to let you know. Right now, Mr. Davies, we need you to take us through everything you can remember." She gestures towards his chair, before pulling out her own with a screech, slapping a thin cardboard file on the table between them. The second officer takes his seat, his huge frame swamping the small plastic chair. He opens a notebook and uncaps a pen. Dominic eyes the chair with frustration. He wants action and consequences, not talking and note-taking. but sensing the resolve rising off the female detective, he takes the seat. Lawson, he remembers. D.I. Sue Lawson. She'd introduced herself earlier. Her younger colleague, the rosy-cheeked young man with the bleach-blonde hair and shoulders that would be better suited to a muddy rugby shirt than a starched police uniform, is Barrett. No, Barnett. D.C. Barnett. Lawson nods, and Barnett starts the recording device resting on the table between them.
To reiterate, states Barnett, clearing his throat, your participation in this interview is entirely voluntary. You can leave at any time, though, of course, he adds, the more information we can gather about the weekend's events, the more successful we are likely to be with our investigation.
I've already told you, says Dominic. It's not me you need to talk to, it's that kid. He's got something to do with it, I know it.
The Search Party by Hannah Rachel is read by Beth Eyer and Jamie Parker and runs for 10 hours 13 minutes.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Our next Yodel Carnegie shortlisted book is Away With Words by Sophie Cameron. Gala and her dad, Jordi, have just moved from home in Catalonia to a town in Scotland. Gala doesn't speak much English and feels lost, lonely, and unable to be her usual funny self. Until she befriends Natalie, a girl with selective mutism, the two girls find their own way to communicate, which includes gathering other people's discarded words. The audio version of Away With Words by Sophie Cameron was being recorded at almost the same time I'm recording this, so we don't have a clip, but hopefully by the time you listen to this, it will be available in the library. But here's author Sophie Cameron to tell us more.
Away With Words is a teen novel set in a world where words physically appear as people talk. So they fall from people's mouths and land on the floor or whatever's nearby, and they pile up there until they're cleared away or eventually dissolve. So the story is about an 11-year-old girl called Gala, who's just moved from Cadaqués in the northeast of Spain to Fortros in the northeast of Scotland. She's moved there with her dad to live with his new partner. So the story is really about her struggles to adapt to a place where she's not fluent in the language within the context of this world where speech has a physical element. And also her new friendship with Natalie, who's a girl in her class with selective mutism, who collects other people's discarded words and uses them in creative ways.
So where did the idea for the book come from? What inspired it?
It really came from my own experience of learning languages. I did the opposite trajectory to Gala. I moved from Scotland to Spain, though I did so as an adult. So it was a very different experience from what she goes through. And the idea of words having this physical element really came from my difficulties with pronunciation. I find it very frustrating and when I know just how a word is supposed to sound in a foreign language, but I just can't recreate it properly. So it sometimes feels as if the words are kind of trapped physically in my throat. So that's where I got the idea from. And more generally, I wanted for quite a while to write a book about language learning because it's something that's interested me for a long time. Both the sort of the difficulties of it and the frustrations, but also the benefits and how the sense of achievement that you feel when you realize that you're finally making progress.
How many languages do you actually speak?
Well, I speak Spanish and Catalan well after I've been here 7 years now. So I speak those pretty well. And I studied French at university and have managed to keep quite a good level of that. And then I've studied about 10 or 11 others, I think, but I've forgotten most of them. At the moment, I'm concentrating on Korean, which has been fun. And I'm finally getting to a stage where I can have a semi-decent conversation. So probably around 5, but to different levels.
Now, we are Read On, the audiobook show, so we're all about audio. How important is audio to learning a language?
I think it's really important. I mean, everyone's got different language styles. Some people learn better with audio, some better with print. But I think probably most people definitely need the audio at some stage for the words to really stick, especially certain languages. You can't tell how a word's pronounced just from reading it. English is a prime example, really. How would you tell the difference between read or read or lead and led without the audio? And even as a native English speaker, there's words that I realize I've been pronouncing wrong for a long time because I've only seen them written down. So yeah, I think for most people, from especially and for myself included, like the audio format's really important for language learning.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself, and do you listen to them in different languages?
Yes, I do. I do mostly listen to them in English, but I'm trying to listen to more in French and Spanish at the moment. Yeah, I really love audiobooks, and actually probably I'd say maybe I listen to, in terms of what I read now, it's maybe 60% audio and 40% print. I think a good narrator can really like bring the story to life in ways that maybe the print version can't for some people. I find like I particularly like listening to audiobooks when it's set in a place where people might have like a specific accent or speak in a specific way, and you know the narrator will bring so much to the book that my interior monologue or my, reading my head like wouldn't. So yeah, I'm a big audiobook listener.
Now, how do you think they're going to deal with the audio version of Away With Words, where the words actually become part of the illustrations?
Yeah, I'll be really interested to see how they do it. Like you say, there's some text design in the book where we see the words, the way they're set out in the page sort of plays into the story. And also because Gala's a second language learner and she's not fluent yet, there's, especially at the beginning of the book, quite a lot of the words are actually blanked out, and you put like squiggly lines to show where she's not able to catch everything that's being said. So I'll be really interested to see exactly how the producers will interpret that, whether it'll just be a blank or whether it'll be muffled. And yeah, it'll be really interesting.
Same with the Braille version as well. It'll be really interesting to see how they produce that.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
But now the audio and Braille versions are being created, is it important that it's now accessible to everyone, say, with sight loss or with a print disability?
I think that's so important. Accessibility is just so important. Everyone deserves access to stories, and in different formats as well. I remember I had a good friend when I was at university who was visually impaired, and I remember her saying when she was younger how expensive audiobooks were. Her parents couldn't really afford to get her that many, so she was reliant on the libraries, but at that time it would have been cassettes when she was really young, and then CDs later. So there's a limit to how much they could stock. So now obviously I think there's a much greater variety of audiobooks being published. And yeah, I think that's absolutely crucial to make sure that everyone has access to these stories and to as wide a range of stories as possible.
Now, one thing we'll miss with the Braille and audio versions is the cover. Can you give us a little description of it?
Sure. So the cover was designed and illustrated by Pip Johnson, who is one of the designers at Little Tiger Press. And it shows a pair of hands, white hands, Gala's, held palms up with the words Away With Words in large white text over them. And then written around those in there are handwritten excerpts of the book, sentences from it in different colours. So the effect is supposed to show this sort of like, it's like Gala's holding up the words, Away With Words, with other words scattered all around her.
You did mention this briefly, but the settings of the book are both quite important to you.
Yeah, so Fortrose is where I grew up. I lived there till I was 12, and then I went to secondary school there. It's the first time I've set a book in that area, so it was really nice to write about it, and also to write about it from the point of view of someone who's new to the area. It was quite interesting trying to think about what would stand out to them, the things that, you know, I or other people from there would take for granted. And then Cadaqués, I have only been to Cadaqués a couple of times, but I lived in Barcelona for 4 years, so I know Catalonia quite well. And I initially had Gala being from Barcelona, but then I changed it because I wanted Cadaqués and Fortrose. I wanted to pick towns which are more or less the same size in both seaside towns. So there is that aspect which is familiar to Gala, even if everything else about her new home is completely different.
Sophie Cameron, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sorry, there were no clips, but as I say, the book should be in the library by now, where it will join
The Tuscan Daughter by Tessa Harris. This new wartime story was donated by HarperCollins.
Sitting in the gloom of her bedroom in the Villa Martini, the cicadas drumming outside the shutters, and the smell of late roses heavy on the air, Lizzie reread the message for the 10th time. She still couldn't believe what it said. Hugh was dead. The stark news, typed in black ink on a thin strip of paper, was delivered via the Swiss consulate. It shot through her like a bullet to the chest. The man she once planned to spend the rest of her life with was dead, his plane downed over Tobruk 4 months before.
Tuscany, 1942. Having moved from England to the beautiful city of Lucca before the outbreak of war, Lizzie Thornton adores her job as tutor to 8-year-old Cristo, despite the fact that his father, Count Antonio Di Falco, is a notable fascist and supporter of Mussolini. Then war is declared, and Lizzie is suddenly regarded as an enemy in the country she loves so much. When new tutor Vincenzo Baldini arrives, Lizzie is exposed to a new secret world. Vincenzo is actually a member of the Italian resistance, running an anti-fascist propaganda magazine. Lizzie, desperate to be part of the fight, joins Vincenzo's unit, and soon she is head over heels in love. But when someone from her past reappears and threatens to overturn her new life, Lizzie must decide if she has the strength to fight for what and who she truly wants.
He'd been dead all that time and she hadn't known, hadn't sensed something was wrong. It made her feel even more guilty. Her gaze dropped to the emerald engagement ring on her left hand. "To meet your eyes, darling Elizabeth," Hugh had said when he'd proposed one magical night at the Café de Paris in London. He'd always called her Elizabeth, even though everyone else called her Lizzie. More than at any time over the past 2 years since war was declared, she felt trapped. When she'd first taken up the post of tutor, Italy had been the sun-kissed land of Dante and Michelangelo. Now it was her prison. She would never forget standing at the Piazza dell'Anfiteatro as Mussolini's words boomed out over the loudspeaker that scorching June day in 1940. "An hour marked by destiny is striking in the sky of our country." She'd been on a simple errand, but had accidentally found herself caught up in a crowd. Carried along on a tide of excitable people, she'd barely been able to breathe. Milling among them were the black shirt bullies, coshes in hand, ready to strike anyone who stepped out of the fascist party line.
The Tuscan Daughter by Tessa Harris is read by Lucy Walker Evans and runs for 11 hours and 21 minutes.
We have the historical mystery The Shadow Key by Susan Stokes Chapman, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
He wakes to the unmistakable smell of sulphur and a room as black as pitch. What woke him, he cannot rightly say. There is a chill to the room that can only be accounted for by the cold Welsh stone, stone which retains little heat, even with a fire burning fierce in the grate. There is the screech of a barn owl, a sound that has always soothed him despite its harsh hunter's cry. There too has been the sound of running water from the stream abutting the gatehouse. Its watery chime a boon to his tired mind rather than a bane. And of course, that smell of sulphur. It comes and goes. He has tried to account for it, consulted Plas Hellig's gardener about the matter. Fungus in the water, he was advised, a consequence of the stream being so close to the wall, compounded by a lack of natural light on account of the crowding trees. Or, perhaps, the smell comes from the mines up on the nearby hill. If the wind blows a certain way, such things might be possible. In any case, he was told, it is no cause for concern, and so the smell is something he has grown accustomed to. It is not so very bad after all.
1783. Henry Talbot has been dismissed from his post at a prestigious London hospital. The only job he can find is as a physician in the backwaters of Wales, where he can't speak the language, belief in myth and magic is rife, and the villagers treat him with bewildering suspicion. When Henry discovers his predecessor died under mysterious circumstances, he's determined to find answers. Lynette Tresillian lives a lonely life. Her father is long dead, her mother haunted by demons which keep her locked away in her room, and her cousin treats her with cool disdain. She has no choice but to become fiercely self-reliant. Lynette has always suspected something is not quite right in the village, but it is only through Henry's investigations that the truth about those closest to her will come to light, a truth that will bind hers and Henry's destinies together in ways neither thought possible.
Still, something is different this night. He tries to place the anomaly, stares wide-eyed into the dark, but soon it is no good. With a groan, he swings his legs out of bed, and in the dark, his gnarled toes feel for the slippers on the rug, pushing the soft pumps onto his feet, first one, then the other. It takes him a moment to stand, to accustom himself to the stiffness in his joints. He almost changes his mind, almost sinks back down on the feather mattress, but now he has exerted himself, it seems futile to have wasted the accomplishment. And so he forces himself to the window, pulls the curtains apart on their rings. There is no moon, the trees that surround the house unfathomable. He sees nothing. Only when the old man moves to turn away does he apprehend what is out of place. What it was that must have woken him. For there is nothing else to account for it. Beneath the familiar sounds of rural night, the running water of the stream, like an undercurrent, he hears it, whispering.
The Shadow Key by Susan Stokes Chapman is read by Richard Harrington and runs for 13 hours and 16 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world. You just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think talking books is the best thing ever.
Talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Have you ever heard of Books of Your Life when the interviewee couldn't make up their mind? Let's hear once again from Nathaniel Lissor. Now, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Not singular. There were just always books in the house growing up. There were five channels of TV. and so books were just everywhere. My dad, like I said, he gave me, you know, the Spike Milligan memoirs, and he was heavily into Terry Pratchett. So there was Terry Pratchett everywhere. And my mum was a super fan of John Grisham. And so John Grisham was everywhere. My older sister was into Jacqueline Wilson. And so I read all the Jacqueline Wilson books. The older I got, I just kind of like devoured everything. And my younger sister, the older we got, she got into Sophie Kinsella and you know, I would describe them as super rom-coms. And so I kind of like burned my way through all of those. And so, yeah, I wouldn't say there was a singular book growing up, but I do remember in my teens, after I did fall out of love with reading because, you know, I wasn't really represented even in my favorite books, you know, I just wasn't there. And there was a spell when I might have been 16, where Mallory Blackman released the Noughts and Crosses books. And everyone was talking about it. And you were uncool if you hadn't read it. I think I described it recently as my reading life CPR at the time. Oh, wow. Like, I remember reading. This is so cool.
I wriggled my toes, enjoying the feel of the warm sand trickling like fine baby powder between them. Digging my feet even deeper into the dry yellow-white sand, I tilted back my head. It was such a beautiful August afternoon. Nothing bad could ever happen on a day like today. And what made it even better was the fact that I could share it. Something rare and special in itself, as I knew only too well. I turned to the boy next to me, my face about to split wide open from the smile on my face. "Can I kiss you?" My smile faded. I stared at my best friend. "Pardon? Can I kiss you? Well, what on earth for?" "Just to see what it's like," Callum replied. "Yuck! I mean, yuck! I wrinkled up my nose. I couldn't help it. Kissing? Why on earth would Callum want to do something so feeble? Do you really want to? I asked. Callum shrugged. Yeah, I do. Oh, all right then. I wrinkled up my nose again at the prospect. But make it fast.
Knots and Crosses by Mallory Blackman is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by Daniel Philpott and Rachel Atkins and runs for 10 hours and 55 minutes. All the other books in the series are in the library as well. Is there a book that you can happily curl up with and reread?
Ooh, yeah. I read Flannery O'Connor's collection of short stories. And I can really read those, you know, kind of like dip in and out, you know, to, they're all so gothic and they're all so, to me, that they're kind of like perfect, more long form. Funny enough, I did an event recently and met a writer called Donna Ashworth, who also writes poetry. And that's one that I can happily reread. I can reread those poems again and again and again. There was a book, Half a Splendid Son, by Chimamanda Adichie. That's my Sunday afternoon read. Sorry, I'm kind of like pinging around. It would be that, or I loved The Confessions of a Shopaholic. Like any kind of like, I don't know, it's too hard. It's too hard.
Master was a little crazy. He has spent too many years reading books overseas, talked to himself in his office, did not always return greetings, and had too much hair. Ugu's auntie said this in a low voice as they walked on the path. But he's a good man, she added, and as long as you work well, you will eat well. You will even eat meat every day. She stopped to spit. The saliva left her mouth with a sucking sound and landed on the grass. Ugu did not believe that anybody, not even this master he was going to live with, ate meat every day. He did not disagree with his auntie, though, because he was too choked with expectation, too busy imagining his new life away from the village. They had been walking for a while now, since they got off the lorry at the motor park, and the afternoon sun burnt the back of his neck. But he did not mind. He was prepared to walk hours more in even hotter sun. He had never seen anything like the streets that appeared after they went past the university gates. Streets so smooth and tarred that he itched to lay his cheek down on them.
Half of a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Adichie is read by Joy Ellis Rowan and runs for 20 hours and 10 minutes and is available from RNIB Talking Books, as are the short stories of Flannery O'Connor, the poetry of Donna Ashworth and the Shopaholic series. So is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
Yeah, Kwame Alexander. I read it recently, The Door of No Return. That book was so sick. The thing that got me was how vibrant it was. Like, it just got me sucked in, like, immediately. Like, his book was the kind of book where, like, you're reading it on the bus and you're thinking to yourself, like, I think I want to be late just so I can finish a few more pages. It was like, honestly, it was so incredible. This is pretty amazing. When people ask me, oh, wow, it's so amazing, you've been shortlisted for the Carnegies, what do you think your chances are? I say, I read Kwame Alexander and my chances are slim.
There was even a time, many seasons ago, when our people were the sole supplier of the purest and most valuable gold in the world. The river was bedded with enough gold to make a century of royal stools for the Ashanti kings, 1,000 shiny bracelets for their wives. Then came the foreigners, invaders disguised as friends, pretending to be students of our way. with only one lesson to learn. How to steal our fortunes. But we fought them off, protected our rich land, our river, the Ofin River. It flows to the east into the mighty Pra, which travels over 150 miles down to the coast, where it drains into a vast blue unknown that we call the Big Sea. On the rolling sides of Ofin are deep forests and farmlands and villages and a boy of the same name. You see, on the morning of your birth, 11 years ago, your mommy squatted at the edge of the water and Ofin carried her fifth child on its shoulders at first breath. It is true, I was there. That you stopped crying as you floated off like a ship inching towards the horizon. The river Ofin grabbed you with an invisible cord wrapped around each moment of your day, held you like a mother cradles a baby, pulled you like the moon does the earth. Ever since, you and the water have been bound. River and sun, wave and flutter. That is how you got your name, my grandson.
The Door of No Return by Kwame Alexander is read by Cobna Holbrook-Smith, and more of that in a moment. Once again, Nathaniel Lasort, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And that's it for our Yoto Carnegie shows. Every year, children with sight loss take part in the Yoto Carnegie shadowing scheme using Braille and audiobooks supplied by RNIB and Calibre. And the winning author receives a Braille copy of their book during the awards ceremony. Over the past three episodes of Read On, we've talked to as many of the shortlisted authors that we could before the winner is announced next week. The only one we missed was the author of the book you've just heard, Kwame Alexander's The Door of No Return. He has been on the show before in 2019 when we cornered him at the medal ceremony itself, so fingers crossed. But that's us, we're out of time for just now, so see you next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.